Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up later in the show, the House Ag Committee takes on the supply chain issues, but we start today with Taylor Chalstrom.
Hi, welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. Today is Tech Thursday, a bi-weekly segment where we cover technological advances in ag. Our guest today is Joseph Jackson, account manager with FiTech, and we'll be discussing a digital platform and service with sensors to help visualize tree health, irrigation, soil moisture, and climate. Welcome, Joseph.
Hi, Taylor. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here today. Joseph, my first question for you here. One of the goals of this digital sensor platform is to give growers the best opportunity to use resources more efficiently, which is ultimately the goal of modern agriculture. You know, how does the platform accomplish this, and what are growers able to see on it?
Yeah, no, so the simplest way to answer that is really to go back to our core product at FiTech. That is the dendrometer. The dendrometer is a piece of technology. It's been around for a long time, used in ecology for almost a century. So really what we did at FiTech was we brought it kind of into the 21st century in terms of, you know, shrinking it, making it a little bit more able to sit on the trees out in the field, a little bit more hardy. So this is then reporting back how the plant is performing. That is then going to give the grower the ability to farm in a plant-based manner. I think that is a huge game changer for growers to shift from the kind of old school way of farming, which is based more maybe on soil moisture or just kind of general estimates based upon the climate and ET plus ETC. Instead, you're collecting data directly from the crop. Whenever you're kind of cutting out those middlemen and you're going straight to the plant, you're going to have a much better idea of what your actual resource demand is. So how much water does that crop really need to stay out of stress? And many growers find out it's actually a lot less than you may think. And all of a sudden, then they're able to save on water, they're able to save on power, and that's helping cut their costs as well as use resources more sustainably. Really, that concept of plant-based farming is just going to be really able to help growers rethink how they are irrigating, fertigating, really anything they're doing in their orchard.
That's a good point that you make, that oftentimes it's an over application of resources rather than an under application. Just so many maybe just don't realize it because it's just, you know, oftentimes it's not even obvious.
No.
But, you know, I'm sure a platform like this easily can tell you, you know, exactly what the trees need.
No, so we basically report what we call the plant status. So we collect the data off the plants and then report to the grower how it's feeling in terms of stress on kind of a color-rated scale, you know, green being good, red being bad. So they're really able to quickly visually see if they're doing good or if they're not doing so good. And I mean, going back to what you were just saying a second ago, so many growers for so long, there's a big aspect of tradition in farming, which I can really understand growing up in a farming family. You've done it this way for 30 years and you've gotten good results. And, you know, that's awesome. But now as agriculture is being squeezed from different angles in terms of resources and prices, now I think we're going to have to start rethinking some of those things that have worked for so long. And figuring out ways, well, how can we conserve? How can we save? We're still producing just as good of a crop as we always have.
Definitely. Well, Joseph, tell me a little bit about the development of this technology. You know, how and why was the technology developed?
Absolutely. So FiTech actually originally comes from Israel. We're about 15 years old, started there for many of the same demands that I think a lot of great ag tech that's in California now has come out of Israel. Just the resource restrictions there are so tight. The demands on how much water they can use, what kind of water they can use, how they can farm is just, you know, kind of the nightmare for most California farmers already is their presence in Israel. So that's really required a kind of innovation and thoughtfulness behind how they farm that we're now just beginning to be asked to do. So the team that originally started FiTech began developing off of the concept of the dendrometer. Originally, actually, our first crop was cotton. before we even entered permanent crops, and then using that to measure the fluctuations of the stem and taking care of those row crops, then moving into permanent crops. So it was really developed there as a response to figuring out how can they know exactly how the crop is performing so they can care for it.
If it's to my understanding, you've taken the concept of dendrometer and sort of modified it to mm-hmm. where it can be kind of stuck on to individual trees picked out within orchards. Yeah. Can you kind of tell me what some of the features and benefits of that modified dendrometer are?
Yeah, absolutely. So really what it's doing then is it's able, since it's stuck on the tree and it remains on the tree over the course of the entire season, you're actually able to see both on a granular level and a macro level how that tree is performing. So what I mean by that is, since it's on this same tree for a full season, both you'll get to know every day what your stress is and what your growth is. But then at the same time, that's great. You know, in July, you do want to know your updates every day. But now here we are, it's coming to the end of the season. And this is the time when growers are actually opening up it from a different perspective. They're looking at the whole year. So how did this sensor report from this tree over, you know, March to October, to be able to see how did my growth look before nut fill? How did nut fill perform? How was my deficit pre-harvest? How was my post-harvest growth? Looking at all the important stages of, you know, the nut development, the crop development too, when we get outside of tree nuts, they can analyze all of that and have a really unique perspective that is not based necessarily on their memory, but based on actual sensor data.
We're going to be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Agromiora Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromiora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromiora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today. Salty, closed soils can render your crops unproductive. DSAL, formulated by AgroPlanté, is specially designed for sodic and saline sodic soils. DSAL will displace sodium and wash it out of the root zone with irrigation to enhance your soil structure, water penetration, and vitality by decreasing soil salinity. AgroPlanté's DSAL flocculates your soil to promote soil aeration and drainage. With DSAL, you'll create a better soil environment for your crop roots and optimize yield. Contact AgroPlanté today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at agroplanté.com. The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Hi, we're back talking with Joseph Jackson, account manager with FiTech. I'm curious, again, going back to the fact that it really is just a modified dendrometer, you know, going back in time to how that technology has developed, what were some of the areas of improvement that you guys were considering maybe when sensor was being designed? Yeah.
Definitely. So originally, dendrometers were really designed for routine measurement. So when I say they were used by ecologists a century ago, they actually were really widely used here in California in the forests. And what they would do is, you know, once a month, four times a year, they would go out to critical trees, which were deemed to be important parts of the forest, and they would go measure. They would wrap big things around the trees and they would measure the size of the trunks. But this wasn't incredibly a common practice because it was a lot of work. It took a lot of time and it was a lot of effort. So like I said, a couple of times a year, a few times a year. So then we were looking to take that technology and shift it. We're, again, we're wanting to measure the trunk still. So the core concept remains the same, but rather than measuring it occasionally, we were wanting to measure it every single day. So that required developing a sensor that was significantly smaller, that was wireless. So, you know, we could put several of them in an orchard and they could be, you know, in terrible service or miles away from any place, any civilization, still report. So they needed to have a good system of a transmitter attached to them. And those were kind of different things that we brought on to the adaption of the sensor as we were developing it and working on it. And honestly, too, at Phytech, we're not done. We do believe that we got a current great generation in California, but we think we can do better. We really believe we want to keep innovating it. Can we make it, you know, smaller? One of the big issues is since it's on the trunk of the tree for a lot of guys during nut harvest, they got to go take them all down, put them all back up. That's a big hassle. You lose data. So figuring out ways we can keep the sensors on the trees through harvest. We're looking to innovate in all those different regards.
You say they do have to go out there and take them down during harvest. You know, how many, let's just take almonds, for example, you know, how many sensors are growers usually putting in their orchards to try and, you know, determine what their needs are?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So this is speaking specifically about the dendrometer. We normally like to think about our sensor allocations on irrigated block. You know, not necessarily, you know, if you have 80 acres, but it's 2 40-acre chunks, well, I'm going to want to look at each of those 40-acre chunks individually, understanding how they're kind of performing uniquely. Our standard setup is 3. That's just because we want to get kind of a statistical average to you as the grower. You would actually only see one line of data coming from us at Phytech. You wouldn't see 3, but that's because we're aggregating those 3 trees into one average that you're able to see, knowing it's coming from this block. That tends to be fairly common that you'll do one setup with 3 sensors. And we use a satellite analysis to pick a kind of average location in the block to place those sensors. But growers are more than welcome to add additional. I have a lot of situations like with almonds, especially, you might have 2 or 3 varieties in the same block, and those varieties will probably be producing crop and stressing differently. So a lot of growers will monitor their nonpareil separate from their monterays, or other growers might have difficult spots in their field. I have a block of peaches where there's a really bad sand streak, but then there's some really heavy soil all in the same field. So the grower has sensors in his heavy soil and his growers are sensors in his sandy soil. So that way he is able to kind of understand what's occurring in both parts of my field and then plan his irrigations accordingly.
That variability in a field is really important, and ultimately growers are just trying to homogenize their acreage in general. And so that satellite remote sensing imagery, I imagine, mm-hmm. plays a really important part in that. And I see that kind of word, the satellite imagery, coming up increasingly when we talk about new ag tech. You know, how beneficial truly is that imagery to growers? You know, how does it connect to the sensors, that type of thing?
Yeah. So for us, we actually use satellite imagery in a slightly more limited capacity. So what we're after is understanding a block at its peak performance, typically, you know, somewhere between June and August in a lot of crops. And what we're looking to understand and then help the growers be able to use during the season if they want it is, okay, where are we wanting to monitor? Where are we wanting to put that sensor on? Because satellite imagery, even good satellite imagery, we know is not going to be available every single day, brand new. It's just very expensive if you're going to do something like that, to just not really feasible. That was part of the goal of the sensor setup that we're applying, is being able to be in the field and report to you as the grower every day. But to understand where in the field they need to go, satellite imagery plays a really important role. Then all of a sudden we can see, like that grower I brought up a minute ago with heavy and sandy, oh, okay, well, here's some really weak vegetative growth. Here's some really strong vegetative growth. I want to put the monitor here and there. And then we can lock down those locations. And then that data all of a sudden is now reporting to the grower every day, but it's coming off of that kind of satellite foundation.
There's a lot of different entities that provide satellite information. I'm just curious what entity that you guys take satellite data from.
Actually, we use a pretty simple, more publicly provided NDVI analysis that we purchase and then we share with our growers, just for the exact purpose I brought up, that we want to be able to understand where to put our sensors. And then it's not also data that we'll provide to our clients during the course of the season if they're interested in visualizing it, so they can, you know, make any changes in their own orchard. I think part of our problem with real full utilization of satellite imagery is sometimes it tells you things that you can't use. And we're not big on that at Phytech. We really believe that we want to provide growers with actionable data. So sometimes when you see a picture of your field and you suddenly see there's three different hotspots in that field, all of which are really badly growing, but you irrigate the whole field the same, and those hotspots aren't even on the same rows that you can cut off, well, you're just going to watch them burn. There's nothing really you can very easily do to affect that kind of change. So maybe that's good to know, to have in the back of your head that you have some hotspots you need to be monitoring. But that's not something we want to be throwing necessarily in your face every single day. So that's where we're installing the sensors in the specific locations to report to you each day a more, just like what you'd brought up, a more homogenized reading, so that you can make those decisions based off of, you know, an average of your field performance.
Well, this platform sounds really innovative. Joseph, can you tell us a little bit about how growers can utilize and learn more about this technology?
So we at Phytech are, of course, going to be attending a lot of the trade shows here around this year, as well as you can look us up at our website and consider also some of the other different elements of our platform. We didn't talk about them much today because the dendrometer is really, I like to say, it's the heart of what we do. You know, it's sensing that plant. But we're also, you brought it up at the very beginning, we're offering a digital platform that you can build out with a selection of other sensors like temp and soil, if the, you know, depending upon what you're interested in monitoring, even though we do always go back to that dendrometer on the tree, sensing how the plant is performing.
Okay. And just any last remarks for growers that might be interested in this sort of technology or adopting it, you know, what would you tell them if they're trying to get into this sort of thing?
Oh, I would tell them to definitely look around at getting into plant-based farming. Consider one of the best places to start if you're just wanting to dip your toes is the pressure bomb. If you're wanting to make kind of initial one-time purchase, that pressure bomb, it tells you so much when you're considering plant-based farming. It's going to take you that first leg, and then we're there to help pick up after that and help take you even further. It's going to provide you that foundation, understanding how your plant is performing, and then you can take that knowledge and make such better smart farm decisions all the time.
Joseph, thank you for coming on today and talking about this really interesting technology. We appreciate you coming on today.
Taylor, absolutely. Thank you very much.
This is Taylor with My Ag Life signing off.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcast, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Here's our news for today. The Newsom administration has informed regional water districts that it's moving forward with a plan to increase flows from San Joaquin River tributaries. This is from the California Farm Bureau. The California Natural Resources Agency and the State Environmental Protection Agency recently informed water districts that the state was walking away from negotiations on voluntary agreements to help regulate river flows. The decision could create more water uncertainty for farmers. How you view the new winter weather forecast will depend a lot on where you live and farm and your own drought situation. Gary Crawford has more.
I love the winter weather.
He does, I don't. But weather experts are already making forecasts for this winter, aided by what is now going on in the equatorial waters of the Central and Eastern Pacific Ocean. However, for the second year in a row, those waters are a little cooler than normal. That's what is called La Nina, which
tends to have a fairly profound impact on North American weather patterns during the cold season.
Agriculture Department meteorologist Brad Rippey will come back to him in a minute. First, let's go to John Gottschalk with NOAA's Climate Prediction Center. He says, in general, a La Nina pattern causes predictable winter weather in the U.S., and so his group is predicting
above average precipitation and colder than average temperatures for some areas of the northern tier of the U.S., and below average precipitation and above average temperatures across the south.
That's very basically the forecast for the period December on through February. For possible agricultural impacts, let's go back to USDA's Brad Rippey. First, for areas that have been suffering drought over the last year or longer, what would this NOAA forecast hold?
There is promise for some additional drought relief in places like the upper Midwest and the northern plains, where we have just started to recover from that historic summer drought that greatly affected agricultural production for crops like spring wheat, durum wheat, and barley. We also expect to see drought relief in the Northwest extending eastward across the Northern Rockies, and that should help out states like Washington and Oregon, Idaho, and Montana that have been hit hard by drought for several months.
Now, on the other side of this forecast, first, it's not good news for farmers or anybody else in Southern California.
Southern California has been dry for more than 2 years. That's an area that we could see drought further intensify, leading to more water supply issues, especially if that dryness extends into key watershed areas of the southwestern United States.
And that could happen. And now moving east and south, forecasters are looking for warmer and drier than normal conditions into the southern Great Plains. And on that score,
we've already started to see some pockets of drought developing across the southern half of the Great Plains, particularly in Oklahoma and Texas.
And if forecasters are right about a drier and warmer than normal winter,
we could continue to see drought emerging, developing, and perhaps even intensifying across the southern Great Plains.
Possibly on up into Kansas and Nebraska.
So for winter wheat folks, something to watch.
Something to watch. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
California's avocado harvest is nearly finished and appears to be meeting crop projections for the season. This again from California Farm Bureau. By late October, farmers have harvested 263.5 million pounds of avocados, on pace for their predicted output of 265 million pounds. That is far lower than the 2019-2020 season, when the crop totaled 375.5 million pounds. Growers say they were challenged by variable weather, the below-average temperatures, followed by heat waves. The Irrigation Show and Education Week returns in person in San Diego in December. Michael Clements reports.
Registration is open for attendees now, with events starting Monday, December 6th, and the trade show scheduled for December 8th through the 9th. Coleman Garrison, Irrigation Association Government and Public Affairs Director, says you can expect to see the latest innovations in irrigation.
So we're really excited to have our irrigation show in person again. As with everything last year, we had to take a pause on the 2020 iteration of the irrigation show. The ag irrigation side is also well represented. 55% of our exhibitors are actually ag focus. So we're really excited to have the agriculture irrigation industry representing us at the show. We have a new innovation hub and innovation row where we're going to be featuring startup irrigation technology companies. And that coincides with a pitch contest where these companies can help pitch their ideas and, you know, hopefully come away with some new business.
New technology and the American Society of Agriculture and Biological Engineers symposiums are top highlights of the show this year.
The ability of what an irrigation system can do on applying water, when and where, at the right time, right amount, just continues to impress me on what these companies are able to do. And since our industry has been apart for over a year, this is really going to be a celebration of what is happening in the irrigation industry. Additionally, we're excited to have ASABE hold their symposium. this that takes place every 10 years, bringing exclusive insights and research that is happening and impacting irrigation and farming.
This year, Garrison says, is all about innovation and the future of the industry.
COVID, you know, really offered the opportunity for everyone to take an introspective look at where they are at. And what we have at the Irrigation Association have come away with is that our industry is consistently innovating and coming out with new products and new technologies. So we do hope that attendees at the Irrigation Show will come away having, you know, new ideas and a new outlook on where our ag irrigation is really moving forward towards. Of course, with so many companies represented on our Irrigation Show Expo floor, we really think you'll be able to come away with a tangible plan on where things can go and how you can really improve the water efficiency of your irrigation system.
He adds the event showcases how agriculture is working to feed a growing population with limited resources and land availability.
It's really important that our members can interact face-to-face with each other. Nothing can replace in-person meetings and conversations that take place. We're just really excited in the ag irrigation space to be able to help contribute towards the goal of feeding an ever-increasing population. We know water resources are of the utmost importance across the country. Being able to showcase how our industry is being responsible stewards of the water resources available, I really think it's important and hope that your listeners will be able to join us for.
Learn more and register to attend online at irrigationshow.org. Michael Clements reporting.
U.S. Forest Service resources support research and development of wood-based products, including grant programs now available for application, Rod Bain reports.
Innovation in the wood products and wood energy sectors has expanded significantly in just over the last two decades. Some examples provided by Brian Breshaw of the U.S. Forest Service include
increases in tall timber buildings that are using a product called cross-laminated timber or mass timber, and it is allowing us to build buildings that have never been built out of wood before. Sports arenas, tall timber buildings across the country.
And then when you consider
other wood products and biofuels and biochemicals, plus advances in markets for a product called biochar, that is an emerging product that has a variety of applications in land use, soil amendments, water filtration, and even as potential for cattle feed additive.
The future looks bright for new and creative ways to develop wood-based products. The Agriculture Department, through the Forest Service, continues its support of such research and development. Such as?
Our Wood Innovations Program partners with many of our stakeholders, tribes, states, private organizations, to advance markets for wood products. The Forest Service also has our national laboratory, the Forest Products Laboratory, that is working on quite a number of emerging wood research applications for wood products, cellulose nanomaterials, wood products, cross-laminated timber, and others.
And a series of annual awards. The Wood Innovation Grant and Community Wood Grant Programs.
Our grant programs are really focused on trying to develop and expand markets for wood products. So we are working in near-term areas to support these markets that really have a strong connection to sustainable forest management.
For 2022, the two programs are currently accepting applications for $13 million in grant monies.
One is the 2022 Wood Innovations Grant Program, and that program is really focused on strengthening emerging markets for innovative wood products. The second program is the 2022 Community Wood Grant Program, and that program is really focused on supporting the cost of installing wood energy systems or building innovative wood products facilities.
Grant applications for both programs are due by January 19th. Meanwhile, a webinar for interested grant applicants is scheduled for November 9th. At the Forest Service Wood Innovations webpage at www.fs.usda.gov. Breshaw adds,
we have seen with many applicants, when they connect with our regional wood innovations coordinators, that engagement and direction has really helped create high-performing projects that have a good chance of success.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's your news for today. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you. Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Welcome back. The House Agriculture Committee held a hearing Wednesday on the immediate challenges facing the nation's food supply. During Chairman David Scott's opening statement, he emphasized that the nation's food supply is secure. However, the bottom line is, we immediately need more truck drivers. During the hearing, Scott confessed he is, quote, very, very worried.
I'm worried that we could possibly have a delay, a major delay. In our food supply chain, if we do not address this piercing issue of a need for commercial truck drivers. It is an extraordinary profession, and we are now pulling the covers off all of that to really, I have magnified my deep appreciation for truck drivers. They hold the key right now as to whether or not we will have a food supply challenge and shortage. We do not have a food shortage, but the supply is in the hands of our truck drivers.
Scott cited statistics that indicate a vast majority of new drivers quit within the first year. John Sampson with the American Trucking Association says there are a variety of factors behind that statistic.
You know, this is something that was pre-pandemic, something that's been systemic, a systemic problem in trucking for years. And the COVID pandemic just exacerbated the issue. And that's why we saw an uptick, I believe, from about 55,000 short to 80,000 short. What we're doing within the industry, we're trying to increase pay, of course, increase incentives, increase flexibility. Of course, the over-the-road truck driver could be a taxing position to have. We have a lot of competition as well within other industries. The truck driver is a great, a fantastic career, but then all of a sudden, if they need to stay home or stay closer to family, then they'll go to an alternative construction or other job in a similar career path as they would be for a truck driver. And so from a trucking industry, we've got to, we're looking at, of course, a Drive Safe Act, looking at recruiting younger drivers. Right now, we miss that 18 to 20-year-old recruitment. We can't go to high schools. We can't go to the Future Farmers of America and recruit them as a original career. And so if they come in at 21 or 25, they've probably already had a career. And so if we're able to get to them, educate them on the industry, maybe they buy in a little bit more as we're moving forward and build a career out of that as opposed to an alternative career. And so there's a lot of things going on, both military, women in trucking, urban as well, and that's kind of been our focus. But retainment has definitely been a big issue.
Sampson says the industry is trying several things to attract more drivers.
We have been working on industry-wide incentives, trying to figure out how to increase driver pay, increase flexibility, provide them a schedule that may be a little bit more family-friendly, benefits, bonuses. And of course, we're also trying to work on the younger drivers, bringing them in. We've done, there's a lot of high schools right now that are looking at CDL programs. We have been working closely with FFA. I know they've got almost 700,000 FFA students that are part of the system. And so we've been reaching out to the younger set. We've always been reaching out on the military side. trying to get more women in trucking, trying to reach out to those folks that are in the urban communities, really educating them that this is a really this is a fantastic career. This is a fantastic opportunity, and this is something that we've been pushing on, and the image of the industry as well. We've really been pushing hard. Agriculture does that very well on their side, but from a trucking standpoint, we've also been showing them that this is a valuable career path and something that should be looked at.
Mike Durkin, the president and CEO of Leprino Foods Company, testified. Leprino Foods is an American company with headquarters in Denver, Colorado, that produces cheese, lactose, whey protein, and sweet whey. It is the world's largest maker of mozzarella cheese. They export a lot of the product from the West Coast.
My name's Mike Durkin. I'm the president and CEO of Leprino Foods Company, and I'm here to testify on behalf of the dairy industry and our company. Leprino Foods is a family-owned and privately held company headquarters in Denver, Colorado, with 4,500 employees and 9 plants across states of California, Colorado, New Mexico, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and New York. Leprino is the single largest purchaser of milk in the United States and actually supporting over 1,000 farms of dairy farms. We're the world's largest producer of mozzarella cheese and a leading supplier of dairy nutrition products, including lactose and whey protein. The supply chain challenges have significantly impacted our business, and we don't expect them to ease anytime soon. I'm here to talk about a critical component of this disruption that has not received a lot of attention lately, and that's exports. America cannot ignore the impact the crisis is having on U.S. exports. Mr. Chairman, to use your words, I'm here to sound the alarm on the export crisis we're experiencing. Exports are critical to the overall financial health of the entire United States agricultural sector, and in our case, the U.S. dairy industry. Leprino exports 26% of our milk equivalent volume to over 55 countries, well above the industry average of 16%. I'm here to share our story and call on this body to help with solutions across all aspects of the supply chain, including exports, because this is a severe threat to the U.S. agriculture industry. Freight rates from the Asia and the U.S. West Coast are currently 15 times higher than freight rates from the U.S. to Asia, creating a clear financial incentive for ships to depart empty, with no U.S. goods on board versus waiting to be loaded. As a result, shipping companies are refusing to load U.S. agricultural exports, and over 70% of the containers are returning to Asia empty. In September, volume from the California ports was just 3/4 of the normal export volume. This works for carriers. We've been told it's more cost-effective to skip the Port of Oakland, one of our primary export ports, than to accept exports. U.S. agricultural exporters, however, are in a crisis. For Leprino, over 99% of our 2021 ocean shipments have been canceled or rebooked to a later date at least once, and in some cases up to 10 times or more. Over 100 bookings this year have been canceled or rebooked 17 times. This equates to a 5-month delay for our customers who depend on our products, including infant formula companies around the world, that's necessary to feed millions of babies across the world. We have been forced to hold loaded containers in carrier yards using equipment already in short supply. These delays not only put our customers at risk, but we have also experienced unprecedented increases in freight and storage and demurrage fees. One freight bill of $5,500 was dwarfed by the detention and demurrage fees of over $20,000. In total, our freight and storage costs have spiked $25 million in 2021, and we expect it to increase another $25 million in 2022. This export crisis may result in irreparable harm to the American agriculture as customers around the world are questioning the U.S. dairy industry's reliability as a supplier. For example, one of our largest customers have incurred over $500,000 in air freight to get the product to what they need. And they also informed us recently that they will now source their product from Europe. These relationships took years and even decades to develop, and they will not be quickly or easily regained. The U.S. dairy industry cannot stay competitive with expensive and unreliable freight costs. And as this cascades through the entire supply chain, the loss of foreign sales pushes more product into the U.S. market, which pressures wholesale prices and ultimately farm milk prices. There's no doubt this is contributing to the extended period of weak dairy farm margins. In response, the dairy herd is now contracting at its fastest rate since 2009. The bipartisan Ocean Shipping Reform Act of 2021 begins to address the problem. This bill will prohibit the opportunistic carrier practice of sailing to Asia empty when the U.S. agriculture exports await shipment. It has bipartisan and co-sponsorship, which is growing, and should be passed and signed into law. The bill is a great start, but more is needed. For example, major ports across the world operated 24/7, and only recently did they begin to do so temporarily. Given the labor shortage and required training, however, this action is unlikely to provide any relief for at least 6 to 12 months. In addition to prohibiting foreign carriers from leaving the U.S. empty, the administration and Congress must work together to provide our major ports and port workers with the infrastructure and environment to operate and meet demand. Thank you for the opportunity to share the exporter perspective. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Jim Cost of California had some questions for Mike Durkin, as well as for John Sampson of the American Trucking Association.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Durkin, in your testimony, you talked about the importance of La Prino Foods that exports 26% of their products. In California, the number one agricultural state in the union, we export 44% of our agricultural products. Clearly, when you talked about an example that you may lose some market share as a result of the supply chain crunch, there's no guarantee you're going to get that customer back, right?
Absolutely. As I mentioned earlier, this took decades of relationship building and over time. We have no idea whether we'll be able to regain that customer, and our hope is over time we will. The ability to be able to do that, though, means that we need to be competitive. In order to be competitive, we need to make sure that we have shipping rates and prices that we can obviously go to our customers.
That's a good segue, because you also referenced the importance of the Bipartisan Ocean Shipping and Reform Act of 2021 that I've been working with my colleagues on, and Senator Garamendi. And I think that we need to look at this effort, this crisis that we're in, and certainly we saw underlying tones of it when restaurants and schools were closed last spring because of the pandemic. When you take a complicated, complex food supply chain and you turn it upside down, the disruptions can occur. And then now, one of the factors that we've talked about, multiple factors that are causing this supply chain crunch that we're dealing with, but also demand by American consumers for products as this economy is beginning to come back. I mean, the 60 to 70 container ships that we see at Long Beach and Los Angeles port, they're telling me that, I mean, this is in part because of the pent-up demand as a result of the pandemic and other factors and the economy growing. To you and to the other witnesses, I think we need to look at this in short-term and long-term solutions. Yep. Certainly the issue in the short-term efforts, the 24/7 operations with Long Beach and LA, is a positive. But I think we ought to do that with Oakland, don't you think? And we ought to do that with some of our other ports and harbors during this crisis. The infrastructure package, that deals more with long-term efforts to increase our capacity in those areas. On the Ocean Shipping Reform Act, would you put that in the long term or the short term? We'd like to get that passed this year so the Maritime Commission can deal with these containers that are going back empty.
That would be a short term, absolutely.
Right.
But we need to get it passed immediately.
Yeah, and this task force that the president has set up, I think, is helpful with the different disciplines, DOT, USDA, the trade representatives. Chairman Scott talked about the efforts to reach out with the corresponding efforts of the other three committees that have jurisdiction in this area. I think we've got to be working together in a collaborative effort to list both short-term and long-term solutions, and we got to do it at the same time. You have any of the other witnesses, Mr. Durkin and others, advice to give us on how we orchestrate that?
Congressman Costa, good to see you. I would say that agency-wide, we're working very closely with both USDA, DOT, and I think having the committees of jurisdiction working as closely would be extraordinarily helpful. I think when you're looking at the LA Long Beach port system and the 24/7, we're running into bottleneck issues as you continue down the process. We're running into equipment chassis issues. We're running into driver issues.
And we've had those for a number of years, and we're devising rail corridors that will help, but that's the longer-term infrastructure package that will update our capacity.
I think you're looking at communication problems. I think the shipper, the ship line has one goal of offloading and then heading out. I think the port itself has another goal. The carrier has another goal, and the warehouse has another goal. And I think unless you have that communication throughout that entire supply chain and everybody on the same page, I think we're going to continue to see those issues. But I think to your
point— And our products that are coming in and are going out, Mr. Durkin, you and I discussed about the perishable nature, and they're not all the same.
They're not all the same, Representative Thompson. Yep, absolutely. And you have concerns on this. We'll be able to get the product that does go out of date in a certain period of time. And obviously, our customers are waiting for that, and they miss a window on that. It's an issue that we have and they have.
Would any of the witnesses care to comment? My time's expiring here, Mr. Chairman, but I think that when you hit on the collaboration of the other corresponding jurisdictional committees, as well as the task force that the President has set up, we ought to have a meeting together and really divide these into short-term efforts and longer-term efforts to figure out how we can do both at the same time to address this crisis that all of us know is upon us.
You're absolutely right, Congressman Costa, and that's why we're moving with all deliberate speed. And as I mentioned, we're already in contact with Ed Labor and the Labor Secretary. We're already in contact. Of course, as you know, we're working closely with Secretary Vilsack and, of course, transportation.
Well, you have my complete support, and I think the committee, and let us know how we can help you.
We certainly will. Thank you.
We'll have more from the hearing in upcoming shows. That is our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to hear more about, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.